I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Our next guest here on the show has already left me with a number to think about. The number is 65. Apparently, 65 is more than just a target age for retirement. It's the number of countries in the world that have some sort of wall or barrier erected to control or stop the flow of people. Obviously, of all such walls in history, the Great Wall of China is of epic proportion. But of all the walls built in the lifetime of people alive today, the Berlin Wall is, or I should actually say was, the most prominent. Our guest, Helena Merriman, is author of Tunnel 29, The True Story of an Extraordinary Escape Beneath the Berlin Wall. And this follows on the success of her award-winning podcast project, Tunnel 29, which is one of the BBC's most successful podcasts ever. She joins with us now to share a few highlights from this riveting story. Helena Merriman, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with just a simple question. Do you think this is the kind of story, amazing as it is, that it risks kind of falling out of sight, out of mind?
Yes, I do. I think for a lot of people, myself included, who work in current affairs, I'm a journalist, so I'm always looking at what's happening now or to the future. And I think what I have found so fascinating about making this podcast and writing the book is the way in which history repeats itself in the most surprising of places. So when I first started researching this story, in the end, I thought it's actually a very modern story. I mean, as you say, at least 60, 65 countries around the world have some kind of wall or barrier. And here you have the Berlin Wall that was the inspiration for so many of those walls. Also in the story, I'm looking at the Stasi, the dreaded, terrifying secret police in East Germany, which secret police forces now around the world take so many tactics from the Stasi playbook, or whether it's leaders who were desperately holding on to power, as we saw with the protesters storming the Capitol this year and Donald Trump encouraging them. It was very reminiscent of what happened in East Germany and those leaders clinging on to power there. So I found writing and exploring the story all felt very modern.
Back in 1986, I went through Checkpoint Charlie. That was 3 years before the wall went down. And I was out of my league, going through that kind of security clearance with the machine guns guards and the dogs and whatnot. Are you a little creeped out by all of the trappings of this story, all of the hardware, all of the infrastructure that was built there?
Yeah, I mean, those checkpoints were terrifying places to be. And some of the early escapes after the Berlin Wall went up in 1961 were pretty crude affairs. People would just jump over the barbed wire. Some people even smashed through it in vans. But then you had people trying other things, like using fake passports to try and get through. And then what the Stasi did was they would produce these manuals where they would show the border guards. They would have hundreds of different types of noses and shapes of eyes and cheeks and moustaches so that the border guards sitting there could try and compare the photograph with the person standing in front of them. And anyone who got caught would be immediately arrested, tried, thrown in jail, often long periods of solitary confinement. So those checkpoints were terrifying places to be.
Can you address how abruptly the barrier went up in the first place? You already mentioned barbed wire. Clearly, you don't build a wall overnight, but it caught just about everybody by surprise. I guess only the insiders, only the people building it knew it was going up.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think that's one of the things that really makes the Berlin Wall stand out from so many other walls built through history, that the secrecy and the speed with which it was built. So the barbed wire does go up, as you say, overnight. Not the Berlin Wall that we see today, that developed over time. But the Berlin Wall was one of the greatest, the most audacious plots that a government has ever carried out against its own people. The architect was Walter Ulbricht, who was the leader of East Germany. He wanted to build it for many, many years, even by 1961, to stop the flow of people leaving East Germany. It was about to fall apart. Lost about a fifth of the people who lived there. So he comes up with this idea to build a wall and essentially lock those people in. And he plans it. The planning starts months before. So he's buying up barbed wire from places as far as Britain. He had police, his own police force stocking the barbed wire, looking after it, no idea what they're holding it for. And it's not until Saturday, the 12th of August, which is the height of summer. And he's very, Walter Ulbricht is very clever about picking a date when he knows that most people, most East Berliners will be away on holiday, fewer people in the city to cause trouble. So he picks this date. It's the date of the annual children's fair. So you've got kids eating ice cream. You've got fireworks going off. And at the same time, you have tanks rumbling towards East Berlin, ready to cut off anyone who tries to escape. And you have commanders opening these sealed envelopes at 8 in the evening. Only then do they find out what they're meant to do. And then Walter Ulbricht himself, he holds a little garden party. And only when all the ministers are there does he bring them into his main living room and tell them what's about to happen. And then, 1 in the morning, that's when it begins. So they start off by switching off the street light. They don't want anyone to see what's about to happen. And you then have these trucks driving up to the border, depositing these soldiers who then pull out coils and coils of barbed wire and string it between these wooden posts that they smash into the concrete. And over the next 5-6 hours, the Berlin, that barbed wire barrier gets put up through Berlin, dividing east and west. They seal off train stations. And so when people wake up the next day, they're separated from people in the West. It's that quick.
You know, the way you describe that, this is, there's no word I can think of other than sinister for the kind of plotting and the planning and the execution. And then the irony of picking a children's holiday affair, a celebratory day, and having it coincide like that, that just seems, I don't even know, I'm speechless for that.
You're so right. And I think so much of that is down to the character of Walter Ulbricht, the leader of East Germany. And it's really interesting reading accounts written about him by some of the people that worked with him, who say he was as cold as they come. He had no friends. He was terrible at small talk, apparently a terrible sense of humour, but utterly devoted to introducing this form of Stalinism to East Germany. And he would pursue it at any cost. And he had been ruthless in the Second World War. He'd gone over during the Second World War to the Soviet, to Russia, and where he was ruthless at having anyone killed to oppose Stalin. And he brought that ruthlessness back to East Germany. And he was ready to pursue Stalinism in East Germany at any cost, even to the point of building this barrier. And you have these incredible photos, devastating photographs. In the morning the wall went up, the morning that barrier went up, where you see children who now just happen to be on the wrong side of the barbed wire. They were perhaps visiting grandparents the night before, because until that barbed wire went up, you could cross very easily between East and West Berlin. And if they just happened to be on the wrong side, they were suddenly separated from their parents. And you can see there are photographs of border guards holding these children back, not allowing them to go to be with their parents. And thousands of those children ended up in orphanages or foster homes and never saw their parents again.
We have established there was an antagonist. Let's turn our attention now to the protagonist here, a fellow by the name of Joachim Rudolph. Who was Joachim Rudolph?
He's extraordinary. So I've had the pleasure of getting to know him over the last 3 years, doing hours and hours of interviews with him. And he was 6 years old when the Second World War ended, and he has a very dramatic escape from Russian soldiers who have come to Germany to take what's theirs when Germany was divided after the end of the Second World War. But he's a very plucky boy, and he's tiny, he's smaller than all his friends, but he's plucky and adventurous and brave. And he said that growing up in post-war Berlin was really fun because you could play hide and seek in all the destroyed buildings, and you could find explosives that hadn't yet exploded and put them on tram tracks and watch them ignite when trams went over them. So he's a real character, and he's 22 years old when the Berlin Wall goes up. And at first, like many other people, he thinks, I've grown up here, I don't want to leave, so I'm just going to keep my head down and carry on life here. But as the East German government becomes even more controlling and life becomes more difficult, he decides to escape. So one night, he and his best friend Manfred, they scope out various escape routes. It's got very dangerous at that point because Walter Ulbricht has just given the order to border guards that they can shoot people if they're caught escaping. So they know by then that they could be shot. And already some people have started to be killed at the border trying to escape. So they're terrified about this. But one night they crawl through a field with a watchtower just above them with Bopos looking for escapees like them. They crawl through a field, wade through a river, and run up the field on the other side, and they make it into West Berlin. And this is where his story is so fascinating, because you'd expect for anyone to escape from a brutal regime, such as the East German government, that when they make it to the promised land, West Berlin, they would just want to start their new life. But instead, what he does is intriguing. He joins a group of students and they start digging a tunnel to help other people escape from East Berlin.
Yeah. How soon after his own escape does he start turning his attention towards going back and helping others?
Oh, a matter of months. I mean, like 6-7 months. So it's, you know, he's barely even had time to sort of make the most of life in West Berlin. He starts at university there. But what I found, again, very modern and resonant to our current times was that it struck me that his is the refugee story that you don't hear so often. That so many migrants and refugees make it to countries they've been desperate to get to. And for so many of them, the promised land isn't what they thought it would be. And that's exactly what happened with Joachim. You know, he's desperate to escape, desperate to get to West Berlin. But when he gets there, he can't understand it. I mean, he's grown up in a country where they would have communal potty breaks as a way of indoctrinating children with the values of communism. And then suddenly he ends up in the capitalist West Berlin, which is the most American city outside of America, with hamburger joints and late night bars where you can do whatever you want. And as he put it to me, there was freedom, but just too much of it.
Was he disillusioned by it?
It was almost as though he just didn't know how to function. You know, he'd grown up in a country where every part of his life was controlled by the government. So when he was studying at university, he was told exactly where he had to be on which day, what classes to do. There was absolutely no personal choice. And suddenly in West Berlin, he goes to university and it's all up to him. And he's like a deer in headlights. And so he then seeks out other people from East Berlin because they understand each other and they hang out together in the dorm rooms. They cut each other's hair. They reminisce about life growing up. And I suppose what I found so poignant about him then wanting to dig this tunnel under the Berlin Wall is that almost in a psychological sense, I think partly that was him desperately missing parts of his life there, his home, his family, and almost trying to sort of get back and hold on to a part of his past.
How much family did he leave behind?
He left behind mother and a sister, various aunts, a lot of friends. He then helps his mother and sister get to West Berlin, so they join him later. But I think, I mean, it would be the same for any of us if we were to suddenly leave the country where we'd grown up overnight, even if it was a country that we struggled to live in and there were a lot of things about it we didn't like. You would miss so much about the life that you'd once had.
Let's talk in just a moment about tunneling, the actual nuts and bolts of how this proceeded, because there were multiple attempts, I understand, not just one, to burrow under the boundary, under the wall. We'll get to that after a short break here on our show as we're visiting with Helena Merriman. She's author of Tunnel 29, The True Story of an Extraordinary Escape Beneath the Berlin Wall. This is Constant Wonder. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Helena Merriman is with us. She is the author of Tunnel 29, The True Story of an Extraordinary Escape Beneath the Berlin Wall. This book, by the way, based on efforts she did with her research and her production of an award-winning podcast, Tunnel 29, one of the most popular award-winning series podcasts from the BBC, I should say. Helena Merriman, tunneling, it depends on whether it's rock or soil or mud or swamp. I mean, what did he encounter once he went subterranean?
Yeah, good question. I've learned a lot about tunneling in researching and writing this book, more than I ever thought I needed to know. So it turns out if you're going to dig an escape tunnel, the first thing you've got to think about is the soil, because so many of the tunnels that were dug under the Berlin Wall collapsed because the soil was just too crumbly. Others fell in, others collapsed because they had dug into water because the water table was very high. So when Joachim gets going, the first few weeks are spent just scoping out various sites where they're looking for really tough clay that might hold firm. And they're also looking for somewhere they can dig from. So a site not too far from the Berlin Wall where they can be quite discreet. And they, so they go wandering up and down a street called Bernauerstrasse, which is the street that has the Berlin Wall going right down the middle of it. And they find a factory which makes cocktail straws. And they go in and they make up some story to the factory owner. They say, oh, we're just musicians. We're looking for somewhere to rehearse. We're a jazz band. You know, can you let us rehearse here? And the guy who also himself had escaped from East Germany says, I don't believe that. I know where you're up to. And actually, great. I'm all for escape tunnels. I hate East Germany. So yes, come and dig your tunnel from here. You can use my electricity, my water supply, everything. So that's where they begin. And what I love about this choice is it's so daring and brave and sort of crazy, because Bernauerstrasse by that point in the West Berlin side, that's where all the tourists come to look at the wall. So you have these open top buses driving up and down along the border with tourists from as far away as Africa and Asia who've come to see the wall. So they go along the top, they go along on these buses and they've got their binoculars out and they're looking at people in the east, and the border guards are looking back at them. And this is the road under which the tunnelers dig their tunnel, this road that has border guards watching them with their Kalashnikovs ready to shoot. So it's an incredibly brave, but it's a big gamble they made choosing that street.
You know, for those who are not acquainted with the area and the way the wall was configured, it's easy to think of the wall as just being, you know, a few feet across. But we're really talking about a barricade and then sort of a no man's land, a big swath of terrain. And we're talking about yards and yards of tunneling.
Yeah, and it's a really good point to make that, you know, we talked earlier about how quickly it had gone up in that one night. But the pictures that people, that listeners would have seen of the Berlin Wall, would have been pictures once the Berlin Wall grew and was fortified, as it was over the next 28 years. But even during that first year, it became unrecognizable from the barbed wire fence that appeared on the 12th of August. So tank traps, there were trip wires. They added a second inner wall. There was what was called a death strip, which they lined with sand so that it would show up any illicit intruders' feet, and they had dogs, guard dogs there too. So, but yes, by that stage, it was meters upon meters of fortified barricades that ran through the whole of the city.
So what happens with these tunneling attempts? We're not going to be able to talk about every last one in particular, but there were failures along the way.
Yeah, they're not very lucky at first. So they start digging. First, they're beset by a leak. Water comes in. At first, they just think, oh, it's just a bit of rain. Berlin was having a very wet summer that year. And then they realize they have dug into a pipe and the water threatens to demolish the tunnel, which is devastating for them because at that point they've got quite far. Joachim, who is this incredible electronics whiz kid, has made all sorts of inventions for the tunnel. So he strings up lights, he puts hooks, pipes together to bring in fresh air. He even attaches a World War II telephone to the side of the tunnel so that he can call up to the diggers when he's right at the end and get them to pull back the cart of earth along the tunnel. But then the leak almost destroys it. And that's their first very ingenious moment of asking the West Berlin water authorities to come in and help, which amazingly they do. But the real, real difficulty comes when they are infiltrated by a gay hairdresser who has just been recruited by the Stasi. He's young, again, like Joachim, he's only 21 years old. And he'd been blackmailed by the Stasi after they'd caught him smuggling cigarettes. And they turn him and persuade him to become a Stasi spy. And they ask him to infiltrate this group of what's called escape helpers who are in West Berlin trying to help people out. And he finds out about the tunnel and he tells the Stasi. And when the diggers first dig up into a cottage in East Berlin, the Stasi are waiting and they arrest the people who've come to the tunnel one by one until there's just a pushchair lying in the street. And some of them are put in solitary confinement. Some of them are then sentenced to prison for years. And Joachim only gets away very narrowly. But that first attempt is extraordinary, partly because of the Stasi files that I got hold of when I was writing this book. And what's amazing for anyone who buys the book is that you can see those Stasi files firsthand. You can see the handwritten letter of commitment that the gay hairdresser writes when he becomes a Stasi informant. You can read the Stasi files word for word that recorded everything that happened the night that first escape went wrong.
I would imagine there's a fair amount of sleuthing that you have to do to get these stories. I mean, were you able to detect or find anything of those incarcerated individuals who showed up hoping to go down a tunnel and then were arrested?
Yeah, two of the most extraordinary interviews I did were with a man called Wolf Dieter and his wife Renata. And he was trying to help Renata escape. They were divided by the wall, like many people. And they experienced the worst of what could happen when you were caught. So Wolf Dieter is caught. He's subject to a show trial, one of the very first show trials organized by Erich Mielke, who was head of the Stasi. And he's interrogated in a prison. The interrogation goes on for days. They use sleep deprivation. The Stasi don't like to use physical torture because they like the idea that they have standards, that they're civilized, the use of psychological torture. And they eventually get most of the details out of him. And he spends many, many months in solitary confinement and then in prison. And their story actually becomes very beautiful. I won't give it away because I think that's a very, very beautiful story that runs through the book. But they do pay a very high price for their involvement.
Yeah. So let's get to that number 29. It's not the tunnel was never designated. This is not like the 29th tunnel in sequence. We're talking about the success story.
That's right. So the other fascinating thing about this tunnel is that very early on, when the diggers are beginning to realize they don't have enough money to finish making the tunnel, they make a deal with the American TV news network, NBC. And NBC at that point has among its staff a man called Reuven Frank, who's this hotshot TV producer. And he's desperate to win the ratings battle between NBC and CBS News. And he comes up with this big idea, which is to find an escape story, to film everything. So he, again, ahead of his time, he is thinking like a reality TV producer might. So NBC make a deal with the tunnelers. They say, right, we'll give you money. We'll give you $7,500 to pay for tools and equipment and food and cups of tea. But in return, you must let us film everything. And it's one of the most controversial decisions in the history of TV news, because if something were to go wrong, it could, you know, and there were shots fired involving American journalists, that could be the spark that would bring the world to World War III. So it's this incredibly secret deal. Hardly anyone at NBC knows that it's going on. And you have these cameramen who crawl into the tunnel day after day, holding a handheld camera upon which you could only film a minute and a half at a time, and then you'd have to wind it up again and film a bit more. And so they film it. They film this tunnel day in, day out, week in, week out. And so when the first tunnel attempt is betrayed, they're there filming that, and they're able to record it all. And then they try again, because a lot of the tunnelers managed to get away after that first attempt went wrong. They try again in September, and again, NBC are there to film it. And there is this completely extraordinary moment. I mean, I've worked as a journalist for 15 years, and in all the bits of all the footage I've ever seen, this is right up there, where you see the first woman crawling through the tunnel, and it's filmed, it's captured on film, and you see her white handbag, and then you see her crawling through. She's lost her shoes in the tunnel. She climbs up the ladder. She collapses at the top because it's taken her so long to crawl through, and it's terrifying. She's there with her toddler. And the NBC cameras film as 28 more people crawl through the tunnel until 29 people make it through. That's why it's called Tunnel 29. And they film the aftermath. And it's the most incredible documentary, but also the most incredible record of this extraordinary escape operation.
I just can't even imagine how you know where to go. I mean, does this kind of keep you up sometimes at night thinking, how do you tunnel and know you're going to come up in the right spot? Will it be in which room is it going to be? And how do the people get the memo to show up there?
Totally. I mean, it was really complicated. And that's why they had to have these ingenious systems where they would send in messengers into East Berlin, because there were no phone lines between East and West Berlin. When they divided Berlin, they cut everything. So they cut the phone lines too, so that, you know, you couldn't even speak to people on the other side of the wall. So if you're planning an escape attempt, if you're planning to rescue people on the other side, you know, that's a very good question. How on earth do you let them know where to go and when to go there and what the plan is? And that's why they use these messengers, people who had West German passports, but who were living in West Berlin, who were able to cross into the East. And then as long as they came back at the end of it, and they would go in, they would knock on people's doors one by one and say, right, here's the plan. You need to be at this house at X time. And then when the plan was changed, as they inevitably were, when tunnels and the tunnel took longer than they hoped it might, they would have to go in again. And that's essentially what leads to Wolf Dieter the Messenger being caught, because he goes in so many times, and it leads to a chain of events that ends up with him being arrested.
So the porous aspect of the wall had to do with passports, people from the West going through on through those checkpoints. And but, you know, somebody coming through the West, they're going to be dogged by the Stasi no matter what. I even had that experience going through in 1986, being told.
Did you?
Well, I was told by some friends in the East that, don't pretend that you're not being watched and followed.
Mm, absolutely. You know, they may well be a Stasi file on you.
Yeah.
You know, anyone, I think anyone, it's worth checking. I mean, it's their record keeping was astonishing. And I love this little detail that after Erich Mielke, the head of the Stasi, I mean, he's one of the longest serving heads of secret police anywhere in the world. And he's there right through the creation of the Stasi in the late 50s up to its demise in 1989. And one of the first things he did after the fall of the wall was to call through to the Stasi and ask for his own file. You know, there's files on absolutely everyone.
Yeah, you know, it's distrust, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And it was that sense of, even in West Berlin was crawling with spies, and it was very common practice for dissident journalists or activists to have their cognac spiked by Stasi agents operating in West Berlin. You know, the next thing they knew, they would be collapsed on a street and a car would sidle up and they would be pulled in, taken over the border, and thrown into prison. And that would happen all the time. And after the wall fell, there was the most amazing few years of reckoning, where it was revealed just how widespread Stasi spies were and how they got into every corner of society, right up to the mayor's office, to the top of TV networks, newspapers, politics, defense, business. No corner of West Berlin was spared from the Stasi's reach. They were incredibly effective.
Well, back to this documentary that was produced by NBC. I understand there was an attempt by the United States State Department to intervene to prevent it going public.
Yeah, that's right. So they get wind that American TV crews are trying to film escape tunnels. And NBC aren't the only news network that tries to do this. CBS tries to film one too. And the White House really doesn't approve of this, because this is 1962, a very, very sensitive time in the Cold War. Relations with the Soviet Union are not good. And the White House is terrified that something like this will only deteriorate, could only make the relationship with the Soviet Union even worse. And again, there's that worry that, you know, if something were to go wrong in the tunnel and shots were fired, who knows where it would lead. So after they hear that this documentary is being filmed and Reuven Frank at NBC is back editing it, the White House then bans the film. They say it can't be shown. And Reuven Frank is devastated, because he's seen it, he's edited it, and he thinks that it's unlike any other film that's ever been shown before. And for months, he's depressed, he hands in his notice, he's ready to give it all up. But behind the scenes, there is work going on between NBC and the White House. And the NBC are trying to reassure the White House. And they're saying, look, don't worry, we've protected the diggers. We're anonymizing anyone who wants to be anonymous. There won't be blowback. And late in December 1962, Kennedy's White House finally allows the film to be shown. And it's shown and it's broadcast. 17 million homes watch it. And the Boston Globe describes it as probably without parallel in the history of television. It's this extraordinary story that nothing like it has ever been filmed before because it's in real time. And that film helps to shape the future of storytelling and news journalism and documentary making.
Yeah. Well, I'm very interested in knowing, you mentioned earlier that you had a lot of FaceTime with Joachim Rudolph.
Mm-hmm.
All told, how many hours do you suppose you spent with him?
Oh my goodness, a lot. I mean, so it began 2-3 years ago. And so I went to Berlin and spent about a week going to his flat, interviewing him, his wife being very kind and bringing us apple cake and pretzels and cups of tea and asking him hours worth of questions. And then and that was for the podcast. And then when I started to write the book, I wanted to do many more hours of interviews because I wanted to get much more detail on various bits of his life. And then lockdown happened. And at first I thought, oh goodness, this is a disaster. You know, I'm not going to be able to go to Berlin and sit with him and do more of these interviews. But it's funny how life turns out, because actually it turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because it meant that Joachim, like many of the other people I wanted to interview, they had no excuse to say no. There was nowhere else they could be. So when I said, right, can I call you up Tuesday to do some more interviews? You know, there was nowhere else they could be. So they would say, yes, why not? And I spent another 4 hours asking them questions. And yeah, we have a very special relationship now. I sent him a copy of the many hours of interviews that I did with him at the end on CD, and he was very emotional about it and said, oh, this feels like sort of the story of my life here. And that was one of the best parts of working on this project, sort of spending so long with this incredible man with this incredible story.
Well, I want to end with just your assessment of the person, of his character. Was he an open book? Was he guarded? Was he in any way, did he exhibit any kind of either pride or humility on that spectrum? What's the guy like?
I love that question, because for me, actually, beyond the history and the politics, actually, this book and the podcast is really about just some extraordinary characters. And with him, I could talk about him for hours, which I won't do because I know the interview's coming to an end, so I'll keep it brief. He was fascinating because, like, I think a lot of people who grew up in East Germany at that time, he was not used to talking about himself. So he was very happy to talk about the tunnel. He had a phenomenal memory, so he could talk about measurements and sounds and colours, and he would remember everything about how it was that they'd figured out which direction to dig this tunnel. But when I asked him about his emotions, he was much less able to articulate those. And I remember there was a moment in the final day of the interview when he just dropped in that he had started parachute jumping when he moved to West Berlin. I thought that was fascinating. And I said, why? What was it about parachute jumping? And he said, oh, well, the car park for the parachuting club was just around the corner, so it was very convenient. And I said, yeah, but you know, what was your bigger reason? What was the psychological motivation? And he said, well, it was just fun. It was just something to do. We spent about half an hour going over this. And eventually I said to him, okay, just talk me through it. Describe that moment when you're in the plane and you jump out. Describe what it feels like when you pull your cord. What is it that you're feeling? And he gave me this incredibly beautiful answer that moved me to tears, where he said, when I jump out of that parachute, I'm falling through the air. And when I pull on my cord, it is the greatest expression. It's the greatest moment of control that I've ever felt in my life. And he said, I grew up with every area of my life controlled by the East German government. So to be hurtling through the air and to have that moment where I'm in absolute control of my life feels exquisite. And it was this beautiful answer.
Oh, I am so tempted to ask you one last thing, which is, did he remain in contact with those 29 individuals who escaped with his help?
Yeah, well, he marries one of them, which gives away a big twist at the end. So you might want to delete that depending on how much you like to give away in these kinds of interviews. He does. And they, all of them, have this very, very strong bond because of what they went through together. And again, I found that very interesting now that, you know, he says even now he knows whenever he meets anyone in Berlin, whether they grew up in East Berlin or East Germany or West Germany, if they're of a similar age to him. And I think there is still that sense of him trying to find his people again. You know, that's why I think he married someone who was from East Berlin too. And that's why he kept in touch with so many of those people, that they had all gone through this extraordinary thing together. And they stayed together. They stayed friends for many, many years after.
Oh, this is the kind of story that just keeps giving. And I know that if I were to interview you all over again, we would be talking about what you know about his feelings when the wall came down. We're going to have to save that for another occasion.
I know. There are so many. But the good news is that a TV series is being written as we speak. And so that will be coming out hopefully sometime in the next few years. So there will be space and time for people to experience
Excellent.
The story in another medium too.
That's super, super. Helena, thank you so much for being with us.
I've loved it. Thank you so much.
Helena Merriman with us. She's author of Tunnel 29, The True Story of an Extraordinary Escape Beneath the Berlin Wall, and also producer of the podcast by that same name, Tunnel 29. It's actually a bit of a challenge to put yourself in the shoes of East Berliners trying to get out. And yet, even today, we see images on TV of people wanting to get out. Just think about Kabul. Different people, different place, somewhat different circumstances, but people wanting to get out. Well, back to East Berlin, the Soviet role in all of this is clear as we look back. The Berlin Wall was their response to having been checkmated by Western powers. The Soviets were trying to starve out West Berlin and couldn't do it because of the airlift. We're going to step back in history a few years before the tunnel story and talk about that standoff between the East and West and the heroic Berlin airlift. That's coming up next on Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We've been talking about Berlin this hour and about one of the great escapes under the Berlin Wall through a tunnel. And now we're going to turn our attention to the story of why that wall was built in the first place. So we're going to go from 1961 back to 1948. The Soviets in 48 were pretty sure they could starve out West Berlin and thereby push out the Western democracies that were supporting West Berlin. But Truman, President Harry S. Truman, and the U.S. Air Force, they went about a very different plan, had other ideas. They were not going to let that happen. And to learn more about it, I spoke with Giles Milton. He's author of Checkmate in Berlin, The Cold War Showdown That Shaped the World. Here's part of the conversation.
It's absolutely extraordinary. So what happens in 1948 is what the Americans and British have feared might happen, and that is that the Soviets blocked all access to the western sectors of Berlin. They cut the rail link, they cut the road link, and this left the garrisons stranded in West Berlin, and it also left the Americans and British with 2.5 million Berliners to feed, and there is no food inside the city. What are they going to do? They have two options. Either they abandon Berlin, which is exactly what Stalin wants them to do, or they try and feed the city and their garrisons by air. And what begins is this most, as you say, this extraordinary operation. Really, nothing like it has ever been done before or since, is that they try to feed and supply Berlin, their western sectors of Berlin, using only the air. Now, you've got to remember, Berlin needs a minimum of about 4,500 to 5,000 tons of supplies every single day to keep the inhabitants alive. But the only planes available are the Dakotas at this time, and they can only carry 2.5 tons of supplies. So it's going to take literally thousands of planes landing every few seconds into the two airfields in Western Berlin to keep the city alive. Can it be done? This is to be the great challenge of the spring and summer of 1948. Can the Western powers keep the city alive by air alone?
And I understand it's all worked out mathematically on paper before it really even is sold to the authorities to make it happen.
Yeah, there was this fantastically eccentric British, he'd have to be British, wouldn't he, if he's eccentric, I think, British mathematician who sat down with his slide rule and his, you know, equation tables and everything, and he worked out that it was just about feasible to feed 2.5 million people using two airstrips inside West Berlin and the five available airstrips in Western Germany to bring in absolutely everything that was needed for the city. He went to the British commander and said, look, I think we can do it. The British commander said, don't be ridiculous. It's impossible. He then went to the Americans, and the Americans looked at his plan and they said, hey, you know what? We're going to give this a go. And thus begins the Berlin Airlift. And I've got to tell you, when you read it, it's like it's really sort of quite moving to read what happens, because both the Americans and the British, they bring in planes from everywhere around the world, around the globe. So the Americans bring in planes from Hawaii, from Honolulu, from Alaska, from absolutely everywhere, bring them into to Western Germany. The Brits, likewise, they bring them from all their, you know, imperial possessions around the globe, from India, from Burma, wherever. They bring their planes in, and thus they launch this operation to try and save the lives of 2.5 million Berliners. But remember, there's much more than just keeping those Berliners alive. This is about the future of Western Europe and who is going to control really the whole of Europe in the post-war period. So it's an absolutely crucial sort of geopolitical battle taking place here.
I know airplanes are being used for this, but doesn't this strike you as almost a medieval scenario with a city under siege?
You know, when I was writing about it and researching, it really struck me that it was very similar to like a medieval castle, you know, where they'd be under siege and they'd pull up the drawbridges and they'd be inside their castle with limited and dwindling supplies. It was a very, very similar situation in Berlin. But the Berliners were very lucky in they had one this. I don't know if he's famous in America, but General Tunnage Tunner, he was known. Now, General Tunner, during the Second World War, he'd been in charge of flying in explosives and weaponry to the Chinese over the Himalayas, over the hump, as it was called. And he was an absolute expert at airlifts. He knew how to get supplies into very, very difficult places. And General Tunner was put in charge of running the Berlin airlift. And he really sets up this operation that is going to run like clockwork. In fact, it has to run like clockwork, because unless you land a plane every 90 seconds into both of the airstrips in West Berlin, the city is going to starve. So it's a pretty tall order, but General Tunner is determined it's going to work, and he sets up this incredible regime, basically, to bring in food and fuel into the city. And really, I set out in the book exactly how it's done, but it's a pretty amazing operation. Nothing like this has ever been done in history before.
And you've informed me that Tunner, this guy had some experience doing a smaller airlift, but this is really interesting, over the Himalayas?
This was over the Himalayas into China. He was running guns into the forces of Chiang Kai-shek in China. But, you know, that was, I mean, it was a big operation at the time, but Berlin dwarfed it completely, because Berlin was just on an altogether different scale. And you know, the stakes, as I say, were very high. Either the city would starve, or, you know, the West were going to lose Berlin and possibly lose Germany as well. And who knows what would have happened if Stalin had got control of Germany. So there is a lot hanging on General Tunner. And it should be, you know, it's worth pointing out that Berlin, it was feasible to do this in the summer months. But Berlin in winter, it's cold, it gets a lot of snow. And even more difficult and dangerous is it's very often fog bound. And so by the time November, December comes around, they can't land planes every 90 seconds. Some days there are no planes getting in at all. The city's on the brink of starvation. And it's really touch and go as to whether they can keep the Berlin airlift going through those tough winter months.
This is a time in the history of this region when the Allied forces institute some kinds of processes of denazification, where you have to take people who were formerly loyal to Hitler and somehow bring them around to thinking in a new way. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because one of the most extraordinary stories you tell has to do with a former general of the Luftwaffe who is quickly, I don't know, he's enlisted to assist with the airlift.
Yeah, this is an extraordinary story. The as you say, the idea is anyone who's had any links to the former Nazi regime is considered, you know, they're not to be employed, and they have to go through this denazification process. But some Germans were needed because they had skills and they had expertise, which both the Americans and the British needed. And one of them was this highly decorated Luftwaffe general who'd been involved in the battle for Stalingrad, you know, that great struggle against the Soviet forces in Stalingrad. He'd survived. He got out alive. And General Tunner, running the airlift, he needs German engineers to basically mend the planes. These planes are taking a hell of a pounding, you know, going into Berlin. They're flying around the clock. They're getting beaten up. And he needs these German technicians. So he actually offers a job to this highly decorated ex-Nazi Luftwaffe commander to mend the planes. And that thus begins one of the more bizarre Allied partnerships in the post-war period, where you have this Luftwaffe general working on behalf of the Americans and working very hard and managing to keep these planes in the air and therefore keep Berlin alive.
A big question. Let's go up, you know, 60,000 feet in the air and look down at the whole situation over these 4 years. I'm just curious about your opinion on how is it that over this time hostilities don't break out. And I should probably qualify that, because there is the story of, I guess, a Soviet tower that is dynamited at some point. But that's not, you know, trench warfare against one side against the other. How do they keep a lid on things?
You know, I think Europe was on the brink of World War III. In fact, the British commandant actually said, he quoted in his diary, he says, "One step wrong now and it's World War III." The world, it seems extraordinary now to think of this, because, you know, this is only a few years after the end of the Second World War, and people are already talking about World War III. And one of the ideas to supply the people of Berlin with food and fuel, instead of doing it by air, was to force a kind of massive military, a regiment through Soviet-controlled territory and basically force a passage through to the western sectors of Berlin. But Truman really worried that if they did this, they would end up, that it would be the beginning, like a declaration of war, even though one could consider what the Soviets had done as a declaration of war. But I think the world was on the brink. It really was within a whisker of World War III breaking out. And it was, everyone was very aware of this. And I think everyone was, it was so close, but it just didn't get that final nudge into warfare, thank goodness.
So was the airlift then calculated? Yes, a humanitarian need there, but was it also calculated to just go on? I mean, that's a costly and dangerous proposition to do that whole thing. But was it calculated to sort of fatigue the Soviets into standing down?
I think the Western powers, particularly the Americans and British, who really acted together in Berlin, the French often acted slightly differently, but the Americans and British, they realized that they had to stand by Berliners. These are the citizens of West Berlin who wanted to live, you know, having lived through 12 years of a Nazi Germany, they wanted to live in a democratically run city and country. And the Western powers had promised to do that. If the Western powers had backed down in, you know, at any point from between 1945 and 1949, I don't know, it would have been such a loss of face. And what after all, were they fighting for in the Second World War? I think they had no option. And don't forget, they were backed up by the famous mayor of Berlin, Ernst Reuter, who's promised the citizens of Berlin, as Colonel Frank Cowley had said, that the Western powers would never abandon Berlin. And so it was a question of really, in a way, of pride on the part of the Western powers. They simply could not be seen to back down in the face of Stalin's aggression.
The Soviets even looked at that compassionate economic program called the Marshall Plan and saw that as synonymous with a declaration of war.
They did. In fact, that's absolutely true. That the Marshall Plan originally, I mean, George Marshall offered to extend the Marshall Plan into Central and Eastern Europe, and Stalin, which by now was in control of Eastern Central Europe, didn't want to have anything to do with it. And indeed, he saw Marshall's plan to regenerate Europe, basically to rebuild Europe and rebuild the economies of Europe. He saw this as a declaration of war. He saw it as America stepping into Western Europe and having a dominant role in Western Europe. And I suppose, in a way, Stalin was right that this was the point at which Europe split into two factions. It really was the sort of starting gun for the Cold War. This was the point at which irrevocably Europe split into two parts. You have the Soviet-dominated East and the American and Western-dominated West of Europe.
Is there a moment or an event when the Allies, the French, the British, the Americans, can say, maybe even exhaling a sigh of relief, we've prevailed, we've got the upper hand now, we can feel secure that the Soviets will back off? I mean, you've got this title, checkmate, in Berlin. I'm just wondering if the checkmate comes at a moment.
Well, you know, I think there is a specific day, you can say, which is Easter Day in 1949, where the Americans and British try to fly in more supplies than they'd ever done before. Remember, the city needs a minimum of 4,500 tons. By Easter Day, 1949, they're flying in 12,500 tons. And this is the point at which Stalin realizes he's lost. He's lost the battle to try and take over the western sectors of Berlin. And quietly, in the corridors of power in Washington, Soviet diplomats begin talking to American diplomats about the idea of perhaps calling off the blockade of the western sectors. And so this is really the beginning of the end of the western, of the blockade of West Berlin. And Stalin basically steps down. He knows he's lost and he wants to call off the blockade. And gradually the airlift will be wound down and the Brits and Americans will be allowed access back into Berlin using those all-important road and rail links.
Giles Milton, he's author of Checkmate in Berlin, The Cold War Showdown That Shaped the World. During this very same time period, with the Soviets in the West wrangling over Berlin, elsewhere in Europe, there were millions of displaced persons looking for a new home, many of them survivors of Hitler's plan to exterminate European Jewry. Where would they go? Well, in 1946, 1,000 of these displaced Jews were seeking refuge, and an organized Jewish underground resistance took up the challenge. It would mean defying the British Navy to get them to a promised land. That story coming up after the news here on Constant Wonder.